CliffCentral.com.
All right, are you ready to meet? You know, I was actually blown away when you walked in here now, Khotsi. You look. Yeah. Well,
thank
no,
you.
I
thank
was.
You for that. I guess.
No, I mean, look, I'll read your CV to people in a second because you are by no means someone we shouldn't know about. But when you walked in, I mean, you look just like your father.
In a good way or bad
way?
No,
in a good way.
Because some people think of it as a bad way, of like a target on me immediately.
No, dude. I went to your dad's book launch.
Yeah.
And I thought he you know, did a great job of explaining to us what happened to poor old Thabo Mbeki.
Yeah.
But
poor old Thabo Mbeki.
Yeah, your dad, Frank Chikane, who we all know well. We're talking to Khotsi Chikane, who is a man who's got quite an interesting story to tell.
Yeah.
Some of the politics that he went into in the Must Fall movements. He's just written a book called Breaking a Rainbow, Building a Nation, and it covers the university protests that took place in 2015 through to probably now. Right, yeah.
Yeah.
You know those, they're called the Fees Must Fall protests, and they've changed quite a lot about the world of tertiary education and even the politics of modern South Africa. He's written this book about what happened prior to the protests, what led to the events of October 2015 at the various university campuses and nationally. The book is a four-part retelling of what happened on the ground among students, first at Roads Must Fall, then moving to the university responses and management, and what ultimately led to the Fees Must Fall nationwide protests. So welcome, man.
Yeah,
and congratulations on the book. It's about time we had someone write about this important and seminal event.
Yeah, well,
series of events.
Well, trying my best, I guess.
No, you're doing well.
Yeah, we'll see.
What made you want to cover this? I mean, what got you interested in it?
The brutal honest truth. There's an individual called Tim Crow at UCT, Professor Emeritus in Biology, something along those lines. He's the guy who wrote an article comparing the student protest to the Taliban, which is an interesting time of our lives. South Africa was going through a weird period at that time. And he got a few of his colleagues. They came together, and this is about 4 months after Fees Must Fall, and published the book called Fees Must Fall, which was a, I don't want to call them right wing, because that's not the appropriate tag, just very conservative white males who wrote very disparaging remarks about Fees Must Fall from their perspective, which people are allowed to do. But it was a bit frustrating that the first book about Fees Must Fall came from this particular grouping.
A criticism.
Yeah. And then the other criticism is, well, students will write eventually. But a lot of the students who are writing went straight to like academic journals. Now,
well, at the moment, aren't we still dealing with students who are facing prison sentences?
Yep.
As a result of those protests.
Yeah, across the country. If the Department of Constitutional Development and Justice, I think it is, tells us the amount of people, whatever the name is
now. Michael Masuta.
If they can tell us the exact number, that would be fantastic, but it's a huge number. Though, good news, though, about two or three students yesterday did their 3 years of community service.
Okay. They've completed it already.
Yeah, completed it. It has been
an on-off. Are they better people now? Are they able to do more
for others? If you told them, let's go protest tomorrow, I think they'll probably be like, yes, let's go do this thing.
Okay. So nothing has been changed.
No. Until the underlying issues change, I think people will still be on standby waiting for the next blow up of sorts.
So you are not afraid of controversy, because in this book you write, among other things, about how they're different from 1976.
Yes.
They may be education, you know, centered in terms of the specifics of their grievances, but in many ways these are completely different protests. They come from completely different places. The people who are protesting now have a very different worldview and list of grievances to the people in 1976. Just explain a little bit about that.
Well, the biggest one is this boiling tension with the, and I, one of the big narratives, this Rainbow Nation narrative. I use it as like a catch-all phrase to essentially say, young people, be happy that apartheid is over, build the country now. And we say, yes, we want to, but there's these huge impediments in our way that are linked to this Rainbow Nation narrative of everyone should be unified. And that's what makes us slightly different from 1976.
I need this explained, because I'm not the only one. Why are there so many people who would prefer a narrative that isn't about unity, that would prefer a narrative that makes it look like the Rainbow Nation was a sham?
Yeah.
That would like to take the legacy of people like Nelson Mandela, the guy who coined the phrase Rainbow Nation, Desmond Tutu, and a number of others.
Jesse Jackson coined the term.
Was it Jesse?
Oh my God.
Jesse Jackson
really
did come
the king of all
He's the one who pulled through.
Jesse Jackson.
Correction. God bless Reverend Jesse Jackson. All right. So let's give credit where credit's due. Thank you, Pumelele. So why are people so opposed to that narrative? What about that narrative is offensive to people who would prefer? And I want to know what they would prefer.
Yeah. So I actually think the Rainbow Nation narrative is the perfect description of the country, just the metaphor itself, right? So everyone knows what a rainbow looks like.
Multicolored. All works together.
Yeah, kind of. But the colors never intersect.
No.
They run in parallel with one another into infinity, constantly. And that's a perfect description of our country, of we are united in our diversity, but we never recognize our differences by interacting. We just run in parallel in our spaces. And when we do interact, and now you're going to hear my student politic terms, there's always this white hue between the colors. And this white hue I use in the, as my metaphor is these white spaces where people interact. And those are the dominant places where you find racial interaction. And I say, cool, we could have that metaphor, but it means we would forever be running in parallel with each other. What the student protest, at least at the beginning, and there's a lot of changes that happened, at the beginning was saying, we don't want to simply be unified if we don't recognize why we are different. And recognizing why we're different allows us to understand each other better.
This is identity politics.
It is identity politics with class politics with a small
group of things. Is it intersectionality?
So here's the funny thing. So at the beginning of Roads Must Fall, and you can trace fallism before Roads Must Fall, but I'll use Roads Must Fall, intersectionality wasn't there at the beginning.
Yeah.
Right. So Roads Must Fall simply came in and said, so there's a statue, it makes us feel bad. Mm-hmm. Right? I'm simplifying things. There's a statue makes us feel bad.
That was pretty much the crux of the heart of everything.
But as the ideology grew, the ideology only grew as we started arguing with each other.
Mm-hmm.
So intersectionality came in once the woman in the movement said, We've seen this game before. We've read our history. Every time black men gather around and fight for justice, they always push black women aside. We refuse to play this game with you. We are going to change the narrative. So you get the what we call the black radical feminism coming in.
Mm-hmm.
Black radical feminism will come with intersectionality into the argument. It was never there from the get-go.
Mm-hmm.
The same thing with black consciousness. At the very, very beginning, it wasn't a black conscious movement. It was a contestation of ideas that said, cool, bring black consciousness in. Same with Pan-Africanism. Often people are just like, oh, the students had this ideology from the get-go. Most of the time it came from like 8 hours of a plenary, sitting down, arguing
a point.
Sounds
like a waste of time.
And sitting there and being like, oh my God, why can't we get to the point? And then you'll have this one person who drops like just a little bit of wisdom saying, why didn't you say that 7.5 hours ago? That would have saved us a lot of time. But you see these interactions, and that's how you get things such as intersectionality coming in. That's how you get people understanding what it means to recognize someone else's difference. Because that's really what people wanted at the beginning.
But Rukhotsofez, isn't this the point of varsity?
Why are you using his full name? We can call him Khotsi.
No, I just love his name.
Sorry, go ahead. Yeah, I know. I like it too. Go for it. Sorry, I interrupted you.
But the point of student politics, the point of scholarliness is exactly that.
Yes.
It's about debate. It's about moving forward. It's to get the forward thrust is you need the varying ideologies clashing.
Yeah.
That's why we need them. That's why we need them.
Well,
all the way back to when parliaments were formed. That was the point of it, is you want the different people's different views to have an opportunity to ferment.
Yes.
And that way we are able to move the entire society forward.
So I take a very different view on this notion of decolonization from most people. So most people have two camps. They say decolonization is, oh, they want to get rid of colonial legacies. And the other reason is decolonization want to uplift African narratives. And I say, neither one of those two really fit my mindset. In my mind, decolonization is there should be no arbitrary upliftment of a person's argument. Every person's argument should be challenged on
its
the merits of that argument.
Well, I think in that case, probably you'd have most of academia behind you as well.
Right, but the problem was academia failed to acknowledge that certain knowledge bases were arbitrarily being lifted above others.
Mm.
So if you came into a room and people ask, let's study, here's a good example at UCT, let's study medical anthropology.
Right.
And they say, well, how do we have the African opinion on medical anthropology. And the question is, how do you ask that when one of the greatest professors at this university was A.C. Jordan, Paolo Jordan's dad at the time?
Now, he was an actual doctor as opposed to Paolo Jordan, who was a fake doctor.
He was an interesting guy. But A.C. Jordan comes out and he's one of the foremost writers about how medical anthropology in the Eastern Cape. He just wrote in a different way. Now, the question is, his knowledge base has been affirmed. He was a lecturer at the University of Cape Town in the middle of apartheid, when apartheid gave zero whatever about black academics. He went off to go to the university, Columbia University, etc., etc. Why isn't his writing being studied? And the question was, why is the old white person's narrative being arbitrarily uplifted over an African narrative? So,
but isn't that more of an embarrassment then to black people who haven't learnt about him than it is to the white people who supposedly are arbitrarily lifting their own studies?
If the white people were never told about it.
I'm sure there's Native American medicine in America too, but it's not curing people.
So it would be a big thing if the university was never told about it. So I do detail in the book of moments after 1994, a professor called Mahmoud Mamdani comes out to the university and says, we have to change your curriculum. I'm not going to fundamentally alter it and say we only want African narratives. He says there has to be a balance and a better understanding of the African narrative within a university context. There's a whole hoo-ha about it. It's called the Mamdani Affair. And so that in academia, if anything's called an affair, it's always linked back to that. If there's a scandal amongst academics, it's like, oh, it's the Mamdani Affair or the Habib Affair of some sort. And the Mamdani Affair, essentially, was Mamdani, foremost African academic, one of our biggest African academics, was essentially kicked out of UCT because UCT refused to acknowledge his views of we need a balanced narrative in the curriculum.
But this sounds like politics in science, which is always confounding to me because science doesn't care about politics or your feelings. I mean, science is objectively right or wrong.
So science is objective.
I mean, this sounds like leftist postmodernist nonsense, where everything's made up. Yeah, but you know, this is what I'm saying: is where everything's made up. It's all structural. It's all political, and we know that's nonsense. I mean, if you get cancer, there's no amount of structural change you can do to the university or to the hospital that will take the cancer away.
Yeah. So I understand
this when it comes to the humanities. It makes perfect sense. And that's why it's a stupid thing to study humanities. Because you're never going to read
humanities alone.
No, no. But
the I think the humanities has allowed me to get to it.
No, no. So science is different.
No, it's not. Science.
How so?
Science is similar to the humanities, is a construct. And construct. All constructs can
gravity,
be broken.
Gravity is
science fiction. Science fiction, right?
That's not science.
It's not science, but things that start out as wild thoughts that could never be have to be, which is what science does, is you hypothesize, you come up with protocols, you test the theory, and then they become concrete and they become real.
Well, we try to test them under laboratory conditions to make sure that they are objectively true.
It's a belief system. You've got to start from a particular point and work through it. The thing about science is that you can, in some of them, get absolutes. Similar to humanities, similar to politics, similar
to
religion.
There's no absolutes in the humanities.
Similar to religion. Everything is moving at a particular point.
So I can add, so with the sciences, I would agree. Gravity is gravity.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't change.
Whether it was discovered
by Karl Marx, or it was discovered by...
And this is the big fight I used to have with the engineering professors of, cool, like, physics is physics. But people are still political animals regardless. And the issue is not with Newton's first principles. The issue is with the lecturer teaching Newton's first principles.
Yeah, but this sounds like those Republicans in America who say climate change doesn't exist in the face of overwhelming evidence to the contrary.
So this is not to
just
say...
Just because politically it's convenient for them to say
I think those are two different arguments. The argument of saying climate change is a falsity and us saying the first Newton law is a fallacy. We're not saying that. We're saying that exists.
Neither of us are scientists, so this is all conjectural. Let's get back to Fees Must Fall, because it doesn't matter what our opinions on science are. It doesn't. We don't have a valid opinion.
All the doctors are looking at us like, you need a degree.
We're morons.
Yeah.
So here's the deal. You've written this book. What I'm interested in is these activists, these people who've brought about this change, have you tracked their progress since the noise at the beginning? Because we know that this had real effects. I mean, there was a march on the Union buildings.
Yep.
The president made a speech.
Yep.
we had free tertiary education promised.
Yeah, apparently.
So to all to all intents and purposes, Fees Must Fall was wildly successful.
Yeah.
Is that how you appraise it now, having done the research, which again I admire because so many people already have opinions on this without having read as much as you have about it?
Yeah. So my supervisor makes a valid point about the 2015 protests. There's different victories for each year. 2015 was a huge victory because there are no examples in the world where in the span of a week, an agitation is made by citizens and by the end of that week, the demand by the citizens is met by national government through the president making an announcement of some sort of policy change. Now, that's never been heard of. That is a victory that students should keep in their back pocket forever. 2016 is a bit more different because then we shift the goalposts, and we did shift the goalposts quite often.
Right.
We shifted it from 0% fee increment to 0% fee increment for working class students to a free decolonial, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It kept shifting.
Yeah.
And I'm happy with that, but it allowed us to get into this false sense of security of we constantly allow the state to say the state must give us this particular solution. So the state comes out and says, yeah, here's free education. And we say, thank you very much. But there hasn't been enough follow through around the policy process of that. So when you have the issue with NSFAS that you have now, NSFAS is a long-standing issue. NSFAS has been an issue since 2007 when they went essentially broke back then, where NSFAS is at the heart of free education. Now, no one has been paying attention to NSFAS from a policy level amongst the student protesters. And the problem about that is that we're all disparate groups. If you don't have that one rallying call, there's very little reason for all of us to come together. So I think the policy interaction is
low. Is it possible to offer free tertiary education?
In this country?
Yeah.
Yes, it needs the political will.
No, do we have the money?
Yes.
We know how much universities cost, and they already subsidize all of our
students. So here's the funny thing.
All of them.
So here's the funny thing about DHET. We told DHET in 2011, 2012.
By the way, let's look at this in the greater context of the fact that basic education has failed spectacularly.
Yeah.
So we're actually creating an almost artificial, this is a made-up tertiary education situation because the primary and secondary education are a disaster. So what we're really doing is trying to make it look like we're producing students of value at the end of the process, where at the beginning we have no interest in them.
So here's a funny thing. So let me make two points. So back in 2011, 2012, we went to DHET and we said, DHET, it will cost about 40 billion rand, right, to do free education. And they laughed us away. We said 40 billion rand in a sustainable way. Don't touch VAT. You can increase through different taxes. But VAT was like down on our list of things to do. Fast forward 5 years later, they come back with a very similar number adjusted for inflation.
Right.
But they use the VAT, which is very annoying because we thought that's not the sustainable way to
do it. But I mean, you're talking about how to spend other people's money, which is a great game to play.
So here's the reason why we would. So South Africa has this weird situation.
Yeah.
So in South Africa, if you get a university degree, we have the highest return on income for a university degree in the world.
Really?
So it is one of those funny stats in the book. It's one of those bizarre stats, and it's because of the type of inequality.
So our investment turns out to be quite valuable.
Yeah. So if you get a degree in this country, now the problem is there's not enough people leaving the system with a degree because they don't leave the system because they don't have the funds to complete, right? Mm-hmm. But if you leave this university with your degree, except for a few exceptions, you usually get a job. And the return that you get over the long run is much higher. So that was our argument of, if this is the situation of inequality in our country, and university graduates are getting a huge return on their income due to having a degree, this will feed back to the system if you collect that money from students as they move up the ranks in their careers, young professionals.
You're
that,
not
that's
even
the
paying
problem.
Back NSFAS.
So that's the problem.
They aren't.
And that's why I say NSFAS is a huge issue. So I also track NSFAS 2007.
And also, I mean, it's always bothered me. Like, I was taught at a young age, if you get something for nothing, you probably don't really value it.
Yeah.
Right.
So no,
you're you're now talking about students having to pay back. I don't think that's what they want. I don't think that a lot of these student protests were about, give us the money now and we'll pay you back later. Because you can easily get a bank loan for that.
It depends. I wouldn't say all students didn't like think like that, but I would say some students did.
Okay, so
there was a mixed bag of opinion on that.
Not everybody can get a bank loan like that. So Gareth,
education,
you know, the thing about it,
easier than most.
The thing about it is there are so many sets of complexities in the intersectionality of the situation. Yeah, what I'm learning here, using all the big words. But the complexities are around who has access to what and how they have access to it, yeah. Right?
So, well, you mentioned Qadar Asmal earlier, right?
Oh, wow, that's a deep dive.
Don't get me started.
But we have to, because we have to look at why we're at this crux now, why we've come to this problem. Mm-hmm. And we have universities that are oversubscribed because mm-hmm. people are desperate to get in because they think that's the way that they'll make themselves.
Also because we've built no new universities.
No new universities built and Blade promised.
In their defense, they built like two ones, but they're not really efficient yet.
No. And then one of them was burnt down, so that doesn't really count.
Semi-burnt down.
Yeah. By the same people who were protesting the fees, ironically.
Who got shot at by... We'll talk about police at some point because they're interesting. They're an interesting factor.
You could argue that some of these students had legitimate concerns and were interested in finding a financial solution to their problems. And you can argue that some, just like others. In every protest, are looters and rioters
all the time.
And criminals.
And also because we have been raised in this country in a way of venting our anger and frustration and protest that is violent. This is how we have been raised for years.
Still, let's not make excuses for
people. It's not an excuse. It is a reason. One of the things that we have... So I come from Soweto, you know this, right? One of the things that we know for sure in the 80s, to get attention from...
To burn something.
It is burn something, right? Mm-hmm. I knew what a Molotov was
you're talking about history, recent history, but in service delivery protests, this is what desperate people are doing because government doesn't listen to them.
Because we have learned, we have been taught, we have been weaned through a system that says in order to be listened to, this is the way you have to behave, and then you
and
will
how's
be listened
that working out for us?
So I would contend that. So I would agree that throughout history. So I must publish the book and be like, yes, it's all in the book, where I make all these arguments of South Africa's had a habit of protests, right? Because of the nature of our society, the nature of our history.
Yeah.
And that's kind of fallen over into this democratic society that we live in now. And that's how people get their voices. Our issue as the protesters was, at the beginning, we were not violent. The issue that we had was, and this is my hugest gripe with the police, was the lack of training of police officers in a tense and chaotic situation.
Sure. I mean, we
riot
had,
control.
Because
sure. And we've had people who say, you know, shoot to kill and this kind of thing.
Right.
So it's
all
a very
those attackers,
combative.
And all you need is that one person to lose their mind for just a second.
Like at Marikana.
Yeah. And it snowballs into a situation that you can't control. But the people who should be able to control that situation are the police, first and foremost. So like the union buildings. So when I was writing, I was looking at all the video footage of the union buildings. And the one stalking, glaring image was six police officers looking at this gate that's being pushed down. And all I could think was, surely they'll intervene with the situation. And then 20 minutes into it was an E-News broadcast, I think. 20 minutes into it, surely they'll intervene at this point because now they're climbing the trees. Then another 20 minutes, now they're using that stick, poking and prodding, and still no action. And I'm thinking, it is now an hour in, and you've watched the situation escalate. Of course it's going to blow up if you don't intervene in some way or manner. Not in a manner to squash the protest,
but we're also
but to control it.
We're talking about an elite. I mean, let's not forget this. They may not be a financial elite, but we're talking about the top maybe 2-5% of people in South Africa who have actually got access to university education, who are complaining about the means of that access.
Yeah.
These are people already in, Pumi. These are not people outside trying to get in.
Yeah.
We're talking about the people inside who are now... I call it struggle envy because they've looked at the stories of the past and they've seen heroic generations before them who fought very moral and sensible and heroic causes. And they look at their own situation and they're trying to find a cause. Because very often, the academic world can be very boring. And going to university isn't always a full-time business. And for a lot of these people, it's also a means of becoming politically, because a lot of people see politics as the way to making their fortune.
Mm.
It's a way of becoming politically relevant early on in your life.
Yeah.
And a lot of these people have gone into politics.
So I trace, one of the things I talk about is a silent revolution in this country. So people think Fees Must Fall started in 2015. I say if there was a protest on campus that was fee-related, whether it was fees, whether it was finances, mm-hmm. whether it was residences, I link that to a fees must fall protest. And if you think of it that way, we've been doing fees must fall for the past 20 years now, right? So it means there's been this general agitation within this elite group. I will call them elite because university students in any society are an elite group. And even in South Africa, there's an elite group within that elite group, which I talk about called coconuts, which is another interesting
term. So that's very pejorative. Term. Yeah.
But in an interesting way. But this elite also function as what they believe the valve. Of if this small elite within the universities, in particular previously disadvantaged universities, leave, they open a valve for others, right? If everyone believes our American dream, because this is what it really is, our American dream is get to university. And once you're in university, then go get your job. That is the valve that everyone believes. So it is an elite saying, we're the elite of the poor. Because that's what it is. And previously disadvantaged universities
And they're more than happy to point themselves spokespersons of the poor without checking with them.
Elite. Well, sometimes they do. But previously disadvantaged universities are a lot better than previously advantaged universities. So Fort Hare University is a lot better at communicating with the community than a UCT would be. Right. So when they say we're advocating.
A much better relationship.
A historical
relationship, which is much better.
Yeah. And they will say, we're advocating for change in our community. And it's this very different narrative compared to previously advantaged universities. So you see, for them, it's opening the valve for others. Now, you can open the valve for others, but if there's no water coming through basic education, then there's a mixed bag of opinion.
That's the problem we were talking about earlier. Yeah. Look, I want to talk to you some more because we're scratching the surface. Unlike Tito, I didn't budget enough time for this. We've got to talk about the medium-term budget, and I've got to get our guest after 8 in here, and it's already 3 minutes too. So listen, Hotsi, we're going to have to get you back. Thank you for coming. Fantastic. Congrats on the book.
Thanks, it is called
Breaking a Rainbow, Building a Nation. And I think it would be interesting reading to anyone who is I mean, I think we should all be interested in what's going on in student politics and what's happened in student political activity in the last couple of years. So, thank you for the book. Well done.
Yeah.
And we'll get you in again. Yes, of course.
Yeah. 30th of October, book launch, Santon Exclusive Books at 6 o'clock. If you want to hear me say this in person or come attack me.
Absolutely.
I'm always up for it.
Good. I like that you don't invite attack. I don't want anyone to attack you.
Not attack. Like... Arguments.
Don't invite attack.
How's that?
Yeah, we want to have people debate vigorously. We want to encourage people to deal with each other in a civil way. If you don't like what Hotsi says, then please go and talk to him or send him an email. Don't attack him on Twitter.
Angry emails are the worst.
Yeah, but don't attack him on Twitter and don't go to his book launch unless you're going to support him.
Don't attack.
Yeah, don't attack.
Engage.
Right. Engage. Thank you very much.
There we go. CliffCentral.com.